From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A bomb blast rocked the center of the Thai capital, Bangkok, killing dozens and injuring at least 80 people, according to officials. The blast, which was caught on video, took place near the Erawan Shrine, a world-famous tribute to the Hindu god Brahma, visited by thousands of pilgrims and tourists every day. Police said the explosion involved a motorcycle bomb. A police car and ambulances hurried to the Rajprasang intersection, where the bomb exploded at around 7 p.m. local time. Bangkok police reportedly found at least one additional bomb in the area. More evidence of the widespread and growing international public opposition to the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement was on display in New Zealand this weekend, as thousands turned out in cities across that country Saturday, demanding that their government walk away from the controversial 12-nation trade deal. According to media reports, the largest crowds were at the rally in Auckland, where, despite a steady rain, at least 5,000 people turned out. The protesters railed against the secrecy surrounding the TPP negotiations and said many of the provisions will undermine New Zealand's sovereignty, allowing transnational corporations undue influence over the country's laws and regulations. There was also a large turnout outside the parliament in Wellington, with numbers reported in the thousands, and in Christchurch and Hamilton, while smaller crowds were seen in other provincial towns and cities. The protests received extra attention after reports Friday that the U.S. consulate in Auckland posted a notice on its website and reportedly emailed Americans in the country, warning them to stay away from the rallies. No incidents were reported during the demonstrations. 4 days of talks in Hawaii to finalize the deal stalled earlier this month after the countries failed to reach agreement, but New Zealand's Prime Minister John Key said last week he expected it to be signed by the end of the year. The U.S.-backed government in South Sudan condemned the efforts of international mediators and peace talks, with the country's Minister of Information, Michael Makuu, condemning the language of the proposals, while the chief negotiator for the mediation effort, Seyoum Mesfi, said South Sudan was arguing in circles. CCTV's Jerm Chala reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, which is hosting the talks.
What should be the final weekend of these talks? And leaders such as Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni have been flying into Addis Ababa, hoping to witness a deal that will end 20 months of bloody conflict. Instead, they're flying into a very unsettled summit, one on Saturday that was rocked by confusion and accusation.
Parties are told that you must sign this agreement. The language of must is not the language of mediation. The language of must is not a language of peace. It is a language which we do not want to be used. Mediation is supposed to mediate, not to dictate.
IGAD and the United Nations have warned of sanctions and more should the rivals fail to strike a deal by 17th August. But now, with the clock ticking down and regional leaders flying in, South Sudan's government says it wants more time. IGAD's chief mediator says the deadline must stand.
What the mediation is saying is we have heard them for the last almost 20 months. They are repeating the same thing. They are circling the wagon. The people of South Sudan do not want to see this vicious circle continue. This vicious circle must be broken.
Gruptala, CCTV, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
A 4.0 magnitude earthquake woke up the San Francisco Bay Area Monday, with an epicenter near the town of Piedmont, between Oakland and Berkeley. The tremor struck at 6:49 a.m. local time. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, the quake was at a depth of 3.3 miles on the Hayward Fault running underneath the Bay Area. BART trains were briefly delayed for about 10 minutes this morning as a result of the quake, which prompted crews to stop trains and inspect the tracks for possible damage. No damage was found, and the trains were back on regular service, according to BART officials. As of late Monday, there were no reports of serious injuries or damages. The mining spill that has discolored the river in Colorado continues to wreak havoc in the southwestern U.S., making its way into New Mexico and causing severe damage to the economy of the local Navajo Nation. RT's Anya Parampil has the details.
On Wednesday, Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper knelt at the banks of the Animas River to take a gulp from the stream, an attempt to back up the Environmental Protection Agency's claim that, according to their initial tests, the river has already returned to pre-spill conditions. Governor Hickenlooper did, of course, only drink the water after killing potential bacteria in it with iodine. However, the move was made to demonstrate the point that some parts of the river are already safe once again, as the toxic plume of heavy metals, which polluted it last week, slowly dilutes itself. The 3 million gallons of toxins, which include lead, arsenic, and cadmium, has made its way into New Mexico, which, along with Utah and Colorado, declared a state of emergency over the spill. Another nation affected by this spill is the Navajo Nation, which makes up territory spanning the borders of 4 states. The Navajo have also declared a state of emergency, as their livelihood has already been affected directly, as they say they are unable to water their crops or properly care for their livestock. The Animas River flows directly into the San Juan River, on which around 100,000 Navajo live. They have ordered their own independent tests on the water quality. The nation's president, Russell Bege, has promised to sue the EPA for damages, telling Time magazine relocated farmers now need to buy hay and haul water. Others living along the river are forced to drive up to 200 miles to find bottled water. People with an average salary of $12,000 are expending dollars on things that they wouldn't have. The EPA has called the spill tragic and set up a claim system for individuals whose health may be affected in the coming years. According to the data provider ProQuest, there are between 20 and 50,000 abandoned mines, like the one responsible for this spill, around the country. And it is estimated that thousands of them are constantly leaking waste into watersheds. So while this spill has garnered much deserved media attention, it's simply the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the legacy of unregulated mining in the United States. In Washington, Anya Parampil, RT.
A congressional vote on the P5+1 nuclear deal with Iran is set for September. Between wannabe Republican presidential candidates and defecting Democrats like New York Senator Chuck Schumer, the agreement seems headed towards a bitter standoff between President Barack Obama and Congress. RT's Guyan Shichikayan has more.
With the prospect of the Iran deal failing in Congress, the Obama administration is going out of its way to get its message across.
By killing this deal, Congress would not merely pave Iran's pathway to a bomb, it would accelerate it.
In go all arguments, sanctions will not hold.
We cannot dictate the foreign, economic, and energy policies of every major power in the world.
The U.S. will lose credibility with international partners.
We turn around and nix the deal and then tell them you're going to have to obey our rules on the sanctions anyway. That is a recipe very quickly, my friends, business people here, for the American dollar to cease to be the reserve currency of the world.
Allies will walk away from the U.S. on other issues as well.
That is a recipe quickly, my friends, for them to walk away from Ukraine, where they are already very dicey and ready to say, well, we've done our bit.
But no argument seems to persuade those who staunchly oppose the deal.
Greatly saddened, sickened, and frustrated over this deal.
I believe it weakens our national security and it makes the world a more dangerous place.
On television, a war of ads began.
Congress should reject a bad deal.
With celebrities deployed to help the deal pass the legislature.
And the alternative to that is war.
War with Iran is a really bad idea.
The worst idea ever.
Look, we all love our children, and the Iranians love their children.
Do me a favor, okay? Don't let some hot-headed member of Congress screw that up.
The Obama administration has also created a separate social media account for the Iran deal and recently posted a meme, you know, to engage young people in the conversation. This one. It is a reference to the rap classic Straight Outta Compton. But the message was largely ridiculed on Twitter. One says, "This is juvenile, I weep for my country." The other goes, "Satire is dead, actual text-funded tweet by your White House, hashtag sleep tight America." At this point, it seems the Obama administration has tried everything to convince opponents that it is in fact a good deal. In Washington, I'm Ganesh Chekyan, RT.
Regardless of the outcome of the maneuvering in Washington, Iran is making some major moves to rejoin the international community as a player. Early Monday, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif was in Moscow meeting with Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The two held a press conference that covered in some considerable detail the various issues in which the two nations see a lot of common ground, including the war in Syria. The press conference opened with the Russian Foreign Minister speaking through a translator.
We've exchanged our views regarding the situation in the Middle East and North Africa, paying special attention to the efforts on Syrian settlement, which can only be peaceful, political and diplomatic, which can only be achieved through talks between Syrian parties themselves without any external intervention. It is up to the people of Syria to decide the future of their country. We also agree regarding situations in Iraq, Yemen, Afghanistan, Libya, and other hotspots in the region. On all these issues, Russia and Iran maintain that issues should be resolved through a national dialogue without any external intervention, without imposing any recommendations from the outside. We are happy with this meeting. We have regular meetings between foreign ministers. And Mr. Minister reaffirmed the invitation to visit Tehran, and I will gladly visit Tehran at a time that we will agree on. Thank you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
In the name of our God, merciful, good morning. I would like to thank my very good friend Sergei Lavrov for his invitation, and I really hope that soon I will see him in Tehran to continue the good dialogue that we have between our ministries. We've agreed we will continue these talks. Russia and Iran are not just neighbors. We share a lot of common interests, common challenges. We face common threats. And, of course, we cooperate on all these issues. The Russian government and Mr. Lavrov personally played a very important and positive role in talks, P5+1, and Iran talks. Russia is a country which stood with Iran during a difficult time, and of course this will help us have more cooperation in the future. Now that sanctions will be lifted, our countries will be able to have closer cooperation, economic, political, cultural, and all sorts of contexts. We talked about this today. We've agreed to have a meeting of the Intergovernmental Commission this fall, and there will be other contacts between our countries. There will be consular cooperation between our countries, which will benefit the people of Iran and the people of Russia. And as Mr. Lavrov said earlier, we talked about the regional and international issues. We also talked about the Vienna Agreement and ways to implement it, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Russia is in the vanguard of implementing this plan. We also talked about other aspects of our cooperation. Nuclear cooperation, Russia is Iran's number one partner in the nuclear energy industry. As far as regional issues are concerned, we emphasize that all issues should be resolved politically in our region. The people of the countries facing the crisis, it is up to them to decide their future. And it is inadmissible for other countries to intervene and decide their future for them. Iran cooperates with Russia and other friends, and we also talked about Iraq, Yemen, and other places where we see extremism in our region. We believe that we should cooperate, we should consolidate the efforts of all the regional players to address those issues. We reject any kind of external intervention. Any intervention would violate the sovereignty of those countries. This is totally unacceptable. We share a common view on these issues. We believe that all those issues have to be resolved peacefully through dialogue, and we will continue our contacts based on these principles. We should find ways to resolve those issues. Once again, I would like to thank you, Mr. Lavrov, for your hospitality. I would like to thank your government and all the people of Russia. We'll now take a question from the Iranian state television and radio company. Good morning. I would like to thank you. I hope this visit will further strengthen relations between Iran and Russia. My question is to both ministers. I'd like to ask you about the most important area of cooperation between Iran and Russia, especially after the recent agreement. I would like to ask you, in which areas do you plan to cooperate? And I would like to ask Mr. Lavrov, in recent years, Russia's position on Syria has been very constructive, but with the recent news that we hear, does Russia maintain its position, its principal position, or is Russia maybe going to reconsider its position on Syria? It's a shame you're not present at our news conferences, where we regularly talk about those subjects. Considering modern ways of communication, actually you can go back a few years, a few weeks ago, and take a look at what we say on the issue, what we have been saying on this issue. Our position remains unchanged, and we have always maintained that it's up to the people of Syria to decide the future of the country without any external intervention, without any preconditions, without any recommendations imposed by outside players. We strongly believe that the Geneva communique should remain our foundation, and it says that all the issues related to the Syrian crisis have to be resolved through talks between the Syrian government, the government of the Syrian Arab Republic, and a delegation from the opposition representing the entire spectrum of the Syrian government's opponents. And all the decisions regarding future transitional steps and reforms in this country, any decisions made at the talks between the government and the opposition, have to be made based on agreement between the government and its opponents. That's it. And we had a number of meetings with my colleagues from the United States, for example, from Gulf countries, and we always directly, straightforwardly say, yes, we believe that the Syrian crisis has to be resolved politically, and we also openly talk about our differences regarding proper ways, for example, and regarding the future of the current incumbent legitimate leader of the Syrian Arab Republic, while some of our partners believe that it is necessary to agree that at the end of the transitional period, the president has to leave. This is unacceptable for Russia, and we openly talk about this. It's up to the people of Syria to decide this. You should come to the negotiating table, stop pretending that there is only one opposition group which can legitimately represent the entire opposition. We have to make sure that all opposition groups and forces are represented in this delegation, and this delegation has to come up with a constructive platform without any preconditions and engage in talks with the delegation of the legitimate government of the Syrian Arab Republic. This is our position, and if you go back and look at what we have been saying in our recent press conferences in recent months or even years, you will see that this position has remained unchanged from the very beginning of the Syrian crisis.
You
know, I'd like to underscore that in the talks we had with Mr. Lavrov today, just like in the talks we had a few months ago, our countries share the same position on the Syrian crisis, and we totally agree that it's up to the people of Syria to decide the future of their country. And foreign powers should just facilitate a dialogue. There should be no preconditions. We agree about that. The only way to resolve the Syrian crisis is through political means. And we share the same approach with the Russian government as regards we don't agree with outside players making decisions about the legitimacy of this or that government. As regards our cooperation, I have to say that with the sanctions being lifted, all the obstacles for expanding our cooperation in all the areas have been removed. We are neighbors, and we have a long history of economic cooperation in the oil industry and many other areas. And the agreements that we have will now be able to be implemented without any obstacles. So we have a very good situation now that sanctions are lifted, a very good situation for expanding our cooperation. And I think our cooperation will very much benefit from the lifting of these unnecessary sanctions imposed on Iran. Russia never supported those sanctions. Russia has always been against those sanctions. So we hope that this cooperation will now develop. There is also other ways to cooperate based on the agreement we have on isotopes, for example, and we have an agreement with Russia on stable isotopes, and then enriched uranium exchange, natural uranium. This is also part of our agreement, and the UN Security Council resolution speaks about this. We have very good dialogue with Russia on this issue, and peaceful nuclear cooperation between Iran and Russia now after the Vienna agreement will continue. We'll have joint projects, we'll build new reactors at Bushehr, will cooperate on nuclear fuel. There are various areas where we will cooperate more and more in the future. I would like to add a couple more words regarding various areas where we are going to cooperate. Like we said earlier, basically it's all-inclusive. It covers all the basic areas. I would like to emphasize economic cooperation in particular, especially high-tech cooperation, nuclear energy. The Bushehr 1 project has been completed in last year. An intergovernmental protocol and contract was signed to build 8 more units, 8 more Russian-designed reactors in Iran. This is a very promising, huge deal, which will strengthen Iran's energy industry, and at the same time, the non-proliferation regime will be fully maintained while respecting Iran's right to have a peaceful nuclear program. This also is true regarding a non-nuclear energy industry. The outlook is very bright there as well. There are also some infrastructure projects, for example, a railway project. We are interested in agricultural exports from Iran to Russian Federation. We would like to develop trade, economic relations, and scientific cooperation on the Caspian Sea. As far as the Caspian Sea is concerned, of course, we are part of the group of 5 countries, which is to come up with the legal status for this sea. We also develop our military cooperation. Our defense minister visited Tehran this year and signed an agreement on military cooperation, including in the context of the Caspian Sea. This is also important to prevent any threats and risks that exist in this region. I would also like to mention our humanitarian contacts. We talked about this today as well. Now, we have talks on opening a Russian cultural center in Iran and signing an agreement to that effect. We also talked about coordinating different parameters for an agreement, for a visa facilitation agreement, which will enable Russian people to travel more easily in Iran. So we have very diverse contacts which serve the interests of our two nations. A question from Kommersant, please. Good morning, Galina Dudina, Kommersant. My question is for the Russian minister, but if his Iranian colleague could also comment on this issue, I would be very grateful. Let's talk about the visit by Major General Qasem Soleimani, which supposedly took place last week. The U.S. threatened to raise this issue in UN, and they violate Russia of violating sanctions imposed in Iran. What did Moscow do to address the U.S. concerns on this issue? I'd like to say a few words. First of all the comments regarding this gossip has been given, and I don't have anything I can add on this specific issue regarding those suspicions. Gossip is gossip. Let's talk about facts. The sanction regime has been violated by our U.S. colleagues. Some time ago, they released from Guantanamo Bay, where they have dozens of people illegally detained there. So one of those detainees, There were a few people included in the UN Security Council sanction list, members of Al-Qaeda and affiliated organizations. So 4 people from that list were exchanged for a U.S. soldier who was captured in the Middle East. 4 people from that list went to a certain country in the region, exchanged for a U.S. soldier. But those people who were on the UN Security Council blacklist, and the fact that they were sent to a country that agreed to receive them, the UN Security Council and its sanction enforcement committee, were not even informed about that.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.